The National Football League rules. The other pro sports may not worship at the altar of the NFL, but they certainly envy the league's prosperity and popularity. It has not always been so. For decades after pro football began in the 20s, it was a poor cousin to the college game and a joke compared to Major League Baseball. But the early years fascinate Washington Times sports columnist Dan Daly, author of The National Forgotten League, entertaining stories and observations from pro football's first 50 years, in which he maintains the good old days were better than the ones we're witnessing now. He joins me from NPR in Washington. Dan, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Promoting teams and games during the 20s was a challenging exercise. Tell us a little bit about how the Kansas City Cowboys and the Cleveland Bulldogs handled that task.
The Cleveland Bulldogs, which were a team that Benny Friedman, the famous passing quarterback, I have to describe him as a passing quarterback because many in the 20s weren't. Mm-hmm. They were hander-offers and runners. But they would basically send out Benny and the team's publicist a little bit early before the team went out to visit a city, and they'd stop by the newspaper office with a couple of bottles of liquor, and they'd give one to the managing editor and one to the sports editor, and they'd just sit around and talk. I mean, this is how you got publicity for pro football in the very early days. The New York Giants tried to promote a game against the L.A. Buccaneers in the mid-20s by sending one of their players to the top of a very tall building in New York, the American Radiator Building, which was about 40 stories, and positioned one of their receivers down in a park area below, and he completed what they claim was the longest pass in football history.
Not until about the fifth try, as I understand it.
Yeah, exactly. I think a couple of balls exploded when they hit the sidewalk or the roadway, and one of them actually knocked the guy over. But it was enough of an event so that the New York Times, which, like a lot of newspapers back then, paid most attention to college football, gave it a couple of paragraphs, and even the wire services covered it. They had to be very imaginative in those days because, as you say, college football was the game back then. They had the built-in audience because of all the graduates from these various schools. And the pro game realized that the only way they could possibly carve out a share of the marketplace was if they had a game that was more exciting, more offensive-oriented than the college game. And that's why, to this very day, you've always seen the rules more or less tilted in the direction of offense in the NFL.
You propose a sort of motto for one of the antecedents of the NFL called the Cole League. And I'm quoting now, "If I can kill him, I will kill him." How often did it work out that way on the field?
I didn't come across any fatalities. The only fatality I mentioned in the book was in a semi-pro game in Ohio when a player choked on a wad of tobacco he was chewing during a game and they couldn't get it dislodged before he'd expired. That was a fairly common practice, too, in those days for players to chew tobacco as they played. But the Coal League was a very rugged league. It was played in the Pennsylvania coal region among towns, for the most part, that didn't belong to the NFL. Pottsville did, but Shenandoah and Gilberton and a few others basically just fielded their own town teams, got the toughest guys out of the mines, and then would bring in a few NFL ringers over the weekend to just play as kind of subcontractors. They were paid very well for it. But tough games playing on fields that didn't have a blade of grass on them, probably had more coal slag than anything else. If you landed on the ground, you were going to get cut. And the fans were just brutal. Part of the reason was that they would bet so much money on these games. And in the early days, at least, if the home team or the favorite team was in danger of losing, the fans had a tendency to storm the field and prevent the game from ending so that the bets wouldn't have to be paid off.
Pro football during the 30s provided what you call in the book the greatest goal line stand of all time. How did one particular series of plays involving the Bears and the Rams earn that distinction?
I was researching something else, and I was going through a series of days trying to find it, and I just happened to come across a game. As I remember, it was 11 plays from the 6-yard line, something along those lines. The Bears would stop them for 3 plays on 4th down. There'd be a penalty. The Bears were very big on penalties, personal fouls in particular. And they'd get a new set of downs, and the Rams just kept plugging away, trying to move the Bears' line. And the Bears eventually stopped them on the 1-yard line after 11 plays. to me, I've come across some others. The Eagles had one in the Buddy Ryan years that was in that class. But I think for that period to do that kind of thing in professional football was pretty extraordinary.
You celebrate football in the 50s for what you call, quote, the sheer nastiness of it. Does a particularly gruesome example come to mind?
There are almost too many to count in the 50s, really. I mean, that was an unbelievable decade. One thing one of the players did was he would go into the wedge. This was Gil Maynes of the Lions. He would go into the wedge on kickoffs, cleats first. That's how we'd break it up. And
you mean like
time,
jump into
yeah, yeah, he
it
would
with
jump
his feet
up,
up.
He would jump up in the air, and he would go in cleats first.
Yikes.
And one time he really carved up a guy, a San Francisco 49er by the name of Hardy Brown, you know, and left a 20-stitch gash in his leg. And it being the 50s, the guy got sewed up at halftime and came out in the second half and broke the nose of the first guy he saw.
Today's NFL is, of course, a multi-billion-dollar corporate enterprise. Is that in part why you don't think it's as much fun as pro football was before it got so big?
That's a lot of it, I think. I think that's where the emphasis is for the league now. It's such a product, you know, increasing revenues and profits and so forth. In the 20s and 30s and 40s, it was more a case of survival. It was more of what do we have to do to make it to next year, especially when you're going through the Depression and you're going through the war years and so forth and so on. I mean, it requires some imagination. Since the 1970 merger, I mean, the league has made it. There's nothing that's going to really knock the NFL off of its pedestal. And so the emphasis is on NFL Inc. Mm. There really hasn't been the strategic growth that you saw in the early years with the T formation, some of the things they were doing on defense and creating nickelbacks and dimebacks and so forth, all things that took place before 1970. It's really more about the buck now.
Dan Daly is the author of The National Forgotten League, subtitled Entertaining Stories and Observations from Pro Football's First 50 Years. The book is published by University of Nebraska Press, and the author joined me from NPR in Washington. Dan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
A pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Is the NFL better now than it was in the 20s and the 30s? How about the 40s, 50s, and 60s? Visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/onlyagameradio, and tell us which you prefer. That's facebook.com/onlyagameradio.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, a global management consulting firm with 3,000 professionals serving global 1,000 companies, oliverwyman.com. And Trader Joe's, traveling the world to source a variety of foods and beverages like pizza from Italy and cheddar from Australia. Locations at traderjoes.com. This is NPR.